This is Content Content, a monthly podcast featuring the people behind the content. I'm Ed Marsh. This is episode number 18, recorded August 8, 2017. Today's guest is Elizabeth Fraley, who is the CEO at Single Sourcing Solutions, an Arbortext consultancy in Southern California. That's a lot of S's. You can find more about them at single-sourcing.com. Liz, how are you today? How's the weather in SoCal?
Well, so I'm actually just south of San Francisco, so more NorCal than south, in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Whoops.
And it is, as always, perfect. 72 nice. Every day, sunny.
Well, that doesn't sound too hard to take. It's actually 80 here in New Jersey, and it's surprisingly dry for this time of year. So we're thankfully have missed most of the humidity that is striking us, though. It still looms. Yeah. I'll take it. It's summertime. I love it. So no complaints from me about the heat.
That's great. Yeah, no, I grew up, spent most of my life in the Washington, D.C. area, actually.
Oh, okay.
So I know the weather of which you speak.
Yeah. Yes, you know the humidity. The stifling heat and humidity of the summer.
Absolutely.
Well, cool. So you started in D.C., or you grew up in D.C. Why don't you tell us about your history a little bit, and why don't you tell us how you got into the technical communications world and how Single Sourcing Solutions came about?
Well, so it's a long story, actually. I'm actually a computer scientist. I have a degree in computer science, which followed my master's in English.
Okay,
it was 1992. I was teaching that how to write a research paper class, and I required my students to have an online resource, which at the time was Gopher, news groups. I mean, AOL was still around. and by the time I finished teaching that class, I'd had a lot of good questions from the students. I had better questions for myself, but I turned around and did a computer science degree.
Okay, wow.
You'd think it wouldn't work well together, but actually, if you can write structured things well, you can write structured things well. It came very, very close together. So I worked a bunch of things as a computer scientist, and I did computer graphics for a while. I've worked on video card drivers and things like that. And then I got hired to a startup out here in California, which did not survive. And then I was hired into Juniper Networks because of my dual background to actually take them out of unstructured writing and get them to do a whole single sourcing environment at Juniper. I was only person at the time hired to do it for a department of probably 40 people. And at the time, we had over 10,000 pages going to the web and to PDF and, you know, you don't like to measure by the page, but trust me, that was as good a measurement as any at the time. And, you know, so when I was hired to do that, and that was 2000, maybe? Yeah, I think 2000. This was before DITA happened, or was before it was really live and available to everyone.
Oh, right.
And I wrote a paper for ACM SigDoc in 2002. And presented just before Michael Priestley, who was introducing DITA to the rest of the world and saying, hey, everybody should use this. And he's like, well, why didn't you? And I said, well, you guys weren't ready yet. And we started two years ago. So, you know, and that's how I got into all of this.
Wow. So you were starting structured back then. I mean, I thought I started fairly early, but you were like the precursor to DITA. I mean, what were you using? Was it something proprietary or were you doing like DocBook?
Well, so at the time, there wasn't a lot of choice, right? You had DocBook. DITA was just coming onto the scene, but it was still very much IBM's baby, and it hadn't been released to much of anyone. We took lessons from both and sort of, it was DocBook-based, but it was heavily influenced by DITA. Since that time, they have moved to DITA, and that's a whole other story. And when I left Juniper, they replaced me with a team of seven.
Isn't that always the case?
Yes.
You don't know what you have till it's
gone.
Well,
so true.
Interesting.
But like I learned a lot, right? Having done custom doc types, having looked at other ones, deciding pluses and minuses between them. And and you didn't have anything then. There were no content management systems like now. Almost everything you had to build yourself. Not that I would do that today. I absolutely would not. I've come down hard on the other side. Do not customize. Do not personalize. Do not do things that you don't have to do because you don't want to be a software company inside your company. You know, so because I've been on both sides. So that's where I sit.
Well, according to that, I'm doing everything exactly right. But that's okay.
You know, people do. It is whatever is the right thing for you at the time, right? And there's lots of motivations and there's lots of factors beyond just I've got tools, right? I happen to have really good tools, so I don't have to deal with the stuff that's pieces and fit it together and do all the extra work. But, you know, not everybody has that. And culture of company is part of that too, right?
For sure.
So it's not, there's no simple answer to that tool question.
Right. And where I work, it's a very kind of DIY kind of place. So, you know, also there's no budget for what I need to do. So it's kind of, you know, do it yourself. And well, long story there. So tell me, I mean,
your salary is how you're paying for it.
Yes, indeed. For sure. Yes. So you're talking about the past and you're talking about the future that you don't have to do this anymore. What did you have to do back then to get 10,000 pages into structured authoring? I'm assuming it was something in, was it in, like, where did you start and what was the middle piece? Was it XSL or XML?
Oh my God, it was before that. XSL is what, 2002, really? When I first started taking classes from Ken Holman. So, you know, we had, originally, they were in unstructured frame and I want to say it was 8 or 9. And they had WebWorks, and we had a complicated process that we worked on to meet our requirements before we even switched to XML. And we moved a little bit at a time. Hardware Ducks went first, then other stuff, right? Because Hardware Ducks are easier. Not as much versioning and variants, right? But we were putting out Palm docs, we were putting out e-reader docs. They were Microsoft Lit, I think. I don't even remember. It's so far back now.
Oh, wow. The dot lit
file. Right? And we had books, the whole PDF. We had PDFs of every chapter. We had WebWorks creating the HTML output with frames and no frames. And I mean, there were so many output requirements that we did just from, you know, a lot. I had all kinds of scripting and programs behind it to make it work. And I think the very first iteration to get, once we moved the Hardware Docs into XML, we had purchased ArborText. We had publishing engine. Even Juniper had money back in the day. And, you know, we could take advantage of all of that. To get all of the other formats, I wrote a long Java program that was state, it had all kinds of states and features and other other scripts to go along with it. And I think at that point I had XSL by then to do some of that work along the way to replace the WebWorks component and the PDB builder and the eLib reader version. I mean, it was just like, it was not pretty, but you know, you did it yourself because there was nothing. It was, you know, there was nothing then. Well,
right. And I guess that computer science background that you had really came in handy because it doesn't sound like anyone else could have really came in at that point and taken it over or done what you had done, especially knowing the content and the development side.
Well, so you got to remember Juniper is a software and hardware company, right? And I'm in the Valley, so there's software people everywhere. When they replaced me with 7 people, they replaced me with computer people. They did not replace me with documentation people. They actually built an entire tools team for the tech pubs process, just like the tools team that works for the software group. Right. So we had a parallel sort of paradigm this because we were building, I mean, the docs at Juniper, we were building software to make that stuff work. Right. And you can't do that with just one person.
So after you left Juniper, what happened? It sounds like you became a consultant really early on and I guess built your career from there.
I did. I transitioned from Juniper to Northrop Grumman, actually. And it was one of the best jobs I ever had. I loved it there. I learned more about business and working with other groups and finding motivations and selling process to executives and other people in the group and to customers who was at that point federal military people, right? Okay. I presented on Nuke, keeping them up to date with what was going on in dot types from there, which is all S-1000D, or was coming up at that point. There were all kinds of memos from defense, and and they were, you know, they were local here, and I started doing data conversion for them. They were in Interleaf, if anybody remembers what that is.
Wow.
Interleaf's now called Quicksilver, I believe, but they had an old content management system that actually belonged to Interleaf. They were using that, and they had frozen their computers to Windows NT, and they couldn't touch anything because you couldn't upgrade it or you'd break the stuff that was Interleaf, and it couldn't run on anything else. And so they kind of hired me to help them figure out how to solve that problem, because IT and corporate was saying, hey, you can't have an end of life thing in our mission critical process. You got to get off this stuff. They still got some that's that way. And actually today, even every now and again, I'll get an inquiry from somebody who's got Interleaf docs and they can't get that stuff out anymore. There's a set of us that it gets passed around between us, and it's the same customer, and it comes back around. Hey, we've got Interleaf. Can you help us? And the answer is pretty much no at this point, right? I mean, that's the cardinal lesson for XML and DITA and everything else, right? Because underneath, in the end, is an ASCII text document. You will always be able to get your stuff.
Yes. Yes, it's one of the advantages of open source, of course, and one of the advantages of having XML as a standard for documentation is that it's not going anywhere. I mean, similar to HTML, but of course, there's a lot of benefits to XML that HTML does not have, especially that kind of portability.
Yep. I mean, they're both doc types. They're both, you know, in the subset of the world. HTML, XML is a subset of that, and HTML is a subset of that. So really, that's all there, and they're all. Everything you'd want to do, you can do for pretty much all of it, with the little quirks here and there. Just having ASCII documents is the biggest thing of all, right? I've got WordSync documents that you can't open anymore on a 3.5 floppy, which I also can't do anything with. This is why.
Yeah, I think I have a version of Ventura Publisher on floppy disk somewhere that I think I borrowed from my college many moons ago, but nothing to do with it now.
No. So, well, back in the data conversion days, there's an application I found, and a friend I made who was working for them, and I forget what the application is called. It was a huge thing back then, and it actually could take RTF documents and some Interleaf, not all of it. Most anything could go through it and come out the other side with something. It was, you know, and I got the source code from them years, you know, decade ago, but never managed to bother going any further with it because it just wasn't worth the effort. But, you know, you learn a lot when you do data conversion.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah, I did, back in the day, I did an unstructured frame to XML using XML. And I was the guy who had to clean up all the mess after the conversion. So I learned a lot about XML back in the day and converting all that stuff. And, oh, God, I didn't want to touch it for years and years and years after that.
And now it's almost easy, right? At least for some cases. Word, you can get it out, right? You can save it as the
Word X. Right, that's true,
because
it's XML-based now.
You space, backspace, you get a different document. But, hey, at least you get something. And Frame has been really nice the last couple of releases. You know, I can transport DITA written somewhere else into there without any problem. I can port it around. I've been really, my Frame goes back to 8 and it's, you know, it's nice now.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't looked at Frame in a long time. It's interesting to hear you talk about Frame because I thought that you were primarily an Arbortext person. So I didn't know that you used a wider tool set.
We are only an Arbortext channel reseller. That does not mean every customer who comes to us that's the right tool for them. We're kind of notorious in, you know, like somebody comes to us and we say, you know, this is not for you. Maybe you should go talk to the guys at Madcap. We don't have any relationship with Madcap, but if that's the right tool for them, I'd rather they have the right tool for them than the right tool that benefits me. because ultimately they'll be unhappy because it's the wrong tool for them, right? So it is ultimately the wrong tool for me to recommend.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, how similar, I mean, you know, you've said back in the day there wasn't, you know, there wasn't DITA, there wasn't XSL, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of standards. How has that changed for you? And as you know, as you've, as your career has evolved, seeing, like you said before, it was, it's so much easier to do this stuff now. Yeah. Can you talk about that change from now until then and how it's kind of been abstracted at this point?
So my, my opinions have changed a lot over 17, 18 years now. right. And I actually had my first copy of Oxygen was 2001, I think.
Wow.
They've been around for maybe 1 or 2 years longer than that.
I didn't realize they were that old. Wow.
Yeah, they've been around a long time. You know, and any XSL I do, I always do an Oxygen. It's just easier, right? That it works great. I used X-Metal. I've used Madcap. The only one I think I haven't used is Authorit.
Okay.
But most all of them. And every one of them has their place, right? So here's the thing. If you'd asked me this question 15 years ago, I would say, you know, you don't want to be too beholden to any product. And while that's true, there's a dark side to that too, right? Each vendor has an idea where their sandbox starts and ends. And if it doesn't end where you think it ends, you end up with this long discussion between two different vendors on who's going to fix the problem. Right. So, and it is up to us to build those bridges, right? Whenever you build software, you are building software, right? This means you have to do maintenance. You have to be responsible for bugs and any other issues. You are basically becoming a software company, right? And that's a real thing, right? You need all of the scaffolding around making that succeed in the long term. Right. The other half of it is, I've become less adamant about using an open source standard for the final rendering step. And I say it very carefully in that way, because, you know, nobody knew we were going to be publishing to mobile. Right. You don't know what you're going to publish to. I can use FOP, but the indexing doesn't quite really work very well. And if you want that stuff, you kind of upgrade to a professional one. You upgrade to Antenna House, which I know extremely well, or, you know, and sometimes you'll use the area tree to do something really complicated. Some years ago, we took a step procedure, like steps of a task, only we're using S1000D, so we'll talk in DITA terms that are closely related, right? We took basically steps and turned it into a flow diagram with circles and arrows and diamonds and squares and all of that, right?
Oh, wow.
But to do that, you had to like sort of step out and do a whole bunch of other work. And so we had to build this program that would do the publishing for them in order to get that to happen. It was a two-step double rendering process, and we had to do things in the area tree and inside of Antenna House. So you can do that stuff, and it's great that you can, right? But that stuff, they can never replace Antenna House. Despite the fact that we're using FO, getting access to the area tree and that stuff is Antenna House specific, right? The minute you use an extension for anything to do what you need to do, you're tying yourself to that product. And really, I personally think that's okay, right? There's a reason you need to do that, and that's why you picked that tool, right? And the thing your rendering tool is, that's the thing that matters, right? It doesn't actually matter what your script is, because you're going to change the look and feel in 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, and you're going to aim to something else, and it's going to look completely different. You're going to be rewriting all that scripts anyway. All those XSLTs, all those FOSSIs or FO or APP is what we use. What matters is that your source material is safe. Your source material can be transformed by whatever tool you need to transform it to get it to what you need it to be. right? So that rendering step does not feel as important to me anymore because that's constantly changing anyway.
Okay.
The archive source is the thing that matters the most.
All right, that makes sense. So then shouldn't the open source option be the better one since you know it's going to be you're fairly sure that it's going to be maintained or that it's going to be available to you. So for example, I didn't really know anything about the processes you're talking about other than those are the three ones that are in Oxygen, yeah. And I know that only one of them works, so I use that right. one.
Well, so that's not open source anymore, right? You're choosing a rendering engine that works. The only open source rendering engine is FOP. And if you're not using FOP, okay. You're not completely open source, right? And here's the other thing. I open source is amazing in the fact that right now Apache is the most bulletproof web server on the planet, and yet everybody still missed the heartbeat thing, right? the heartbeat blog, what bug? Sorry. Here's the other half of that, right? The reason Apache is so bulletproof is because all those companies who depend on that in their mission critical business process. On their website, they all have a developer in-house who works on that Apache project, right? So they are actually, it's not just, hey, I'm going to use that because it's free. It's, you know what? We're using it. It's free. We better make sure that it serves our needs today and into the future. And we're going to have to make sure that you work on that project so that you can guarantee our interests are protected, right? Hmm. If you do not have someone dedicated working on that open source project, you're at risk.
Right. And I mean, from what I understand, there aren't very many maintainers of the DITA project. And I don't even know what level of support IBM is giving anymore. Should we be concerned that, you know, someone's not going to say, hey, you know what, I ran out of time to maintain DITA and no one's going to pick it up?
So I am going to be a little pedantic here and I hate to do it, but it's the computer scientist in me coming out. DITA and the Open Toolkit are two different things. Right. And DITA is not going anywhere and IBM is still supporting it. There's lots of people who sit on that committee. And in fact, Arbortext is the product they were using when they built DITA at IBM.
Huh.
And I probably know you should actually interview Julio Vasquez if you haven't already. He'll tell you a great story about what it looked like in the beginning and what was going on. But it's his story to tell and not mine. So, from that perspective, there's lots of community involvement, and that project, the DITA, the schema itself, its adoption, and what happens from it, from that perspective, that is perfectly well covered. The Open Toolkit is not a commercial project.
Right.
So you get what you get, and, you know, the last time I tried to do it, it took me 2 days to install and configure, and oh my God, I set up Arbortext in an hour.
So you're saying basically it's let's let the vendors do the heavy work and not worry about the Open Toolkit, or I guess I'm confused because I thought that all of them kind of leverage the Open Toolkit in one way or the other.
No, they do not all.
Oh, well, that's okay. That's new.
Right. The Open Toolkit is not part of MadCap. It's not part of Authorit. It's not. It's not really part of FrameMaker because they've got their own stuff that actually does far better, right? You can get PDF. They created PDF, right? So you don't really need it. They can use it, but you don't have to. Antenna House is not Open Toolkit. It's a rendering plugin, right? It's an engine. It's a rendering engine. Same for RenderX. X-Metals is just the editing side, right? So that's not really plugged in. It can be. It doesn't have to be.
Huh.
Arbortext never was, but it was doing all of that DITA stuff before that existed, really. It had basically DITAVAL in the beginning because they were doing that kind of stuff for DocBook. They were the first XML editor, I think, 1996. X-Metal followed them within a month. And everything else came along afterwards. So it's not that I'm against the Open Toolkit. You know, it's great. You have to really be careful about what your requirements are, right? I do not have time to waste to muck around with that kind of tool mess. I can set up Arbortext in an hour, come up with a style sheet, the two books I published last year, I did that style sheet and it was published and ready and on Amazon within 4 hours. Brand new style sheet. Print ready, EPUB ready within 4 hours. I couldn't do that with the Open Toolkit.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, as you know, because I've asked for some of your help, but I've delved into the Open Toolkit XSL, and since we've talked, actually you inspired me a little bit at Summit, and I've delved in, and I've actually gotten a lot better at it, but, you know, for me, it was just like, holy crap, I can render a page exactly how I want to, and one of the things that I wanted to do was take some of our metadata and expose it on the page, and I did that all through XSL, through plugins, and, you know, customization to the Open Toolkit, and it was just like, this is so cool. I mean, just the power that was just so amazing. And I'm wondering, if something like, I guess you could do that with Arbor Text, but is it easier? Is it the same? Or, in my past research, it seems like no matter what, something needed some kind of XSLT. And I guess
you have to
I don't know which one's better than the other.
There's no better. There's absolutely no better. I refuse to say there is a better. For me, it's better because I have it, number one. And number two, I've been using it for 17 years, so I know it in and out, right?
Yeah, right.
I've been doing XSL and FO since 2002 also. So, I'm the one that when people are like, hey, I can't figure out what this is, they call me. And 15 minutes later, they're done. You know, I mean, it's not – it's just fun at this point. So it was better. It was, how is it better or not better, but how do you make the publishing happen? Right. So XSL is, you can use XSL in ArborText because it's a way of addressing and distinguishing and identifying specific nodes in a tree. Right. That's really what XPath, let's call it XPath, right? XPath is for.
Right. Okay.
It's identifying a specific node or a set of nodes and a way of identifying them uniquely. Right. And so ArborText has a product called Styler, which is putting basically a UI on top of that process. It has all the same things there. You just don't have to code to do it. Right. So I can identify the title node, for example. I know that's an exciting one, but it's the title in a topic or title in a concept or the first title in a concept or the title in a topic in a topic in a topic, that'd be a third level head, right? Or a title in a figure or whatever, right? Or the first title that appears in the set of sheets of graphics, like for military, you've got multiple sheets in one figure, right? So as long as you can identify things and you can in some way describe the regions of the page, then you're pretty much good to go, right? Mm. So, you know, for us, they've pushed really hard to make it so you don't have to be a programmer to do it. I do a graphic layout of the regions of the page. Right.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Here, just like we all are used to, right? Here's the header. Here's the footer. I want the graphic in this X, Y location, and the distance of the region is this far wide and this far high, right? And you can generate whatever you want to put into that region. I can use XSL, or I can use JavaScript, or I can use Perl, or I can use any number of other things to put whatever I want in the region and have the region lay at certain depth, right? Just like in layers in a graphic, I have layers on a page. And I can control that graphically rather than have to think about it and hard code it and test it 3 times. And, you know, it just makes it easier for me to look at. But the rest of it, the rules, the, like you would call them the match templates, right? In XSL, I've got a whole row of templates, only they're in the graphical interface, and I can have contexts and conditions under which a particular rule is called, right? And I can assign properties to that I can define elsewhere. And you can do all of that in XSL too. You know, it's actually a good practice to make sure you are getting stuff formatted the same way if you're using established property sets rather than hard coding it on every rule. We'll just let that go the way it is.
Yeah, it sounds like we both had some experiences with some bad code.
There's always
or some bad
code.
Choices. So while we're talking about Ditta, I guess let's go down this hole. And it's been in the news kind of recently. Our friend Scott Abel, the content wrangler, had a survey on the state of Ditta. You know, I know that we don't have a whole lot of data on this, but this is the only one that I know of that's talking about the state of Ditta. Some of the things that they had reported was lack of a proper reuse strategy, making Ditta do what we need it to do, lack of training, design, to equip. And I don't want to go through all of them, I guess, but what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I haven't seen the results of his survey. I don't know if he published it to everyone or if just the people who paid him for it. I do know that those sound all reasonable to me. I mean, really, you know, it's not an easy proposition, right? You can shove it from one thing to another, docbook to Ditta, frame to docbook, frame to Ditta, you know, madcap to Ditta because it's, you know, HTML. You still have same mess, different tools, right?
Right.
You know, yeah. if you shove it over, what do you expect has happened? Right?
Right, right.
So.
And I did 3 years ago, we were moving from one system to another. And I managed, we were converting from unstructured HTML-based content, and I moved everything into Ditta and did exactly that. I took time to get all the crap out of there, take all the bad topics or the outdated topics. And that's the thing, you know, I mean, as you know, the acronym GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. So, but it's interesting too that, you know, a lot of it seems to be that there's problems with finding people with the skills or training or lack of understanding how to create Ditta content. So I guess there's both sides of it. And I guess I see both sides of it because, you know, as I've mentioned in this podcast, making Ditta do what we needed to do. I'm getting it to do it that way, but, you know, through the open toolkit, and I guess through my fumbling about, it's been fun, but incredibly frustrating. So I see both sides of it. And I guess as a consultant, are you involved in both sides of that? Do you see some of these things that people are frustrated with Ditta and structured authoring in general?
So I don't see a lot of frustration. I see a lot of questions.
Okay.
And we've tried to deal with that in two kind of unusual ways for a consultant. I will say that the shelf method is the worst, and the best case I've seen, Kyocera out here in the East Bay, they rewrote everything. They didn't just shove stuff over. They rewrote everything they went, and they ended up with 85% reuse.
Wow.
Right. That's about as good as it gets, really.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at like the really historical stories, Medtronic HQ in Minneapolis, they were using DocBook. Their project is, I want to say, almost 30 years old at this point. They put things down to the paragraph level and in some cases sentences, and their reuse is through the roof.
Huh.
But they did extreme amounts of work to make that happen. And, you know, they were doing this with DocBook, so there's a lot of handwork you have to do to make it work. a lot of scripting and a lot of other stuff. But their system is a classified class 3 medical device. So, you know, they can actually prove that what comes in goes out. And their price per page is down to like $5, I think, right? For a brand new document. And they can put a book together in a couple of days because they have the reuse all figured out and they really did work on it. So I do find that people who are new to Ditta, the biggest question I see is, oh my God, how do I change that? How am I supposed to mark up this topic? And usually that is a conversation that I have with that person where I say, well, let's talk about what the topic is. You know, is it really necessary? Is it necessary as is? What are you really trying to do here?
Right.
Right. What in the you're the current technical writer, Frog Brain, right? You are trained for 18 years, at least in US schools, you have to have three supporting points. You have to have it like this. You have to have it like that. You can't just have one bullet or one subsection. You've got to have balance. You've got to have, you know, an introductory sentence to introduce this list. Right? You're trained to do it this way. So it's not surprising. It is hard for people to step away from that. But, you know, one of the things that we do, at least with our customers and anybody who's in the mastermind, they get, you know, some time to just sit with me and talk about whatever it is that they're dealing with. And half the time it is just, let's take apart your topic. Let's take apart what you're trying to do and see if that's really what you're trying to do. And the answer turns out to be, oh, I shouldn't do that. I should do this. Right. And that just takes training and exposure and experience and having somebody that you can talk it through with. Right. Who's not your boss or your coworker, and you're going to be embarrassed that you asked the question, or, you know, that you don't look like you know what you're talking about, or whatever reason. It's helpful to have somebody else that you can just call on the phone and spend 5 or 10 minutes and say, let me talk this out. We all need that.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. And I noticed you brought up your mastermind session. I know that you know, you seem to be a very busy person between your consultancy and, you know, TC Camp, which I'd like to talk about a little bit. You know, going to conferences, I guess, to promote yourself. And also what you have, two things on your website are the TC Dojo and the TC Mastermind. Can you talk a little bit more about both of those and how they came about?
So I'm lucky, right? I run a small company, so I can do experiments so long as everyone thinks the experiment is valid to do, right? I never just say, hey, we're going to do this, and we go and do it, because people would drag their feet, they'd sabotage, you know, all the things that people do when they don't want to do something they're being told to do. But, you know, I have a tendency to experiment, and my team likes to do that also. So the mastermind is one of the experiments that we tried. I'd had conversations with customers, three or four months in a row. And I kept wishing that I'd had them on the same phone call, because one would solve one problem one month and the other would solve that a different month, right? Or one had experience for something that they could have lent to the other, right? We all solve the same problems over and over. We just do it in different orders according to our priorities, right? And that's what conferences are good for, right? You get to go talk to people who are doing other things, or get ideas for what you'll remember 5 years from now. Hey, I remember something like this. So I asked all of them, I said, hey, you know, what do you think about coming into a group call once a month? It's going to be run by you all. Maybe we'll do some clarification of issues. If you have a certain topic you want to talk about, and you don't really know, we can do some research and do a little tiny bit of training and discuss that specific topic. So like recently we talked about, handling graphics. Right, and updating graphics graphics in the workflow of publishing. Before that, it was, do we going to keep inline linking, or should we get rid of those altogether? But they all said, yeah, let's get together on a phone call. And we did that for a year, just my customers together on a phone call. And we opened it up to more people after that year completed. And now we've got a couple of them running. We've got one for Arbor Text only. We've got one for TechConf General. I've got a Windchill one, and I'm thinking very seriously about creating one for MilSpec, because we're seeing a lot of small players who are getting into doing a book for the Air Force or a document for the Army, and they're brand new, and they don't know what to do, and they need a little bit of people to talk to, because they're one or two people in a small company. And that can be really hard when you're by yourself, or you're the only one, or you're the only two.
Right.
So I'm thinking about launching that other one. We did launch a fourth one for people who are independent or want to be consultants or want to go out on their own. It's called the Conclave. And that's been different and interesting, right? So, because it's not so technical focused, it's more professional skills.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
So, and it's been fun, right? TC Camp also was an experiment. I had no idea whether anybody would show up. In that first year, we had 160 people. Who knew?
Do you want to tell us? Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about TC Camp? How did that? I mean, obviously, it came out as an experiment, but you started on the West Coast. I know there's an East Coast one because I presented there a little bit last year. And I know there's another one coming up. So here's your pitch. Give us a pitch.
So TC Camp, I've been running data science on conferences for the ACM. That's the STC for computer science for like 10 or 12 years. And I was like, I wonder if this could work for TechCon. And I shopped it around a good long time before we held the first one. But out here in the West, we don't have any local conferences anymore. So there's no Spectrum, there's no Interchange, there's no Conduit. And they were all, we've got five active STC chapters. We had six at the time. STC closed one of them. They're thinking closing another one. But so we've got lots of people here. And we just said, hey, let's have it on conference, see what happens. And a lot of people showed up. It got huge reviews, especially from some of our toughest STC critics locally.
Nice.
And, so we did it the first year. We did it the second year. It got to be a lot of work, so we spun it off as its own nonprofit. And Scott Prentice is the CEO of TC Camp. I just sort of do write the checks. I'm the treasurer. And when Alan Howler joined the board, he said, hey, let's try a meet. And so last year was the first one there. And we're super glad to get you to come and, and give a workshop. But I forgot people in the East go on vacation in the summer. You just don't do that out here.
Oh, right. Oh, really?
No, they don't do that out here.
So when do you take time off, or you're just working all year round?
There, people take a lot of time off in the winter for skiing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. If you're in the sun all the time, you go where it's cold and get away from the sun.
I guess. I don't know. I don't have to get out of the sun.
Yeah.
But, so this is our second year in the East. It's all UI UX out there. One of the things that's most interesting to me for TC Camp and with the dojo too, like the dojo we started the dojo because people wanted camp to happen more often. And we said, hey, that's a lot of work. We're not doing that. So we took the dynamic part of camp, where the voting and the topic suggestions and the community driven side of things. And we made the dojo that way. So there's a survey that runs constantly. We check it all the time. We bump speakers and find different ones based on what people want to learn. Like, why should I tell you what to learn? You should be telling me what to learn, because you know what you need to learn. I don't. I can just, say, hey, this is beneficial to me if I drive you this way. So this must be important. I don't know. It's not my, I'm a public service. I should have gone into government service. I'm a public service person. it's just the way it is. And a crazy volunteer all the time. But that's, the dojo came out of that. And so now with the camp on the East Coast, we're going to try, this will probably be the last year that we run both. It looks like next year, Rob Hanna of Precision Content and Keith Shangley Roberts from Ixiosoft are going to hold it in Toronto in 2018. They're going to try a couple of different things, because what works out here doesn't work everywhere else, right? Out here, Tech Camp always has a pre-camp day, and it's always an API doc writing workshop. That is the number one topic out here every year, always. If we've had Sarah Maddox come out and do a free day at Google, when Alan tried to have her come to Washington and do the same class, he couldn't fill the room. It's not because Sarah is not any less loved in the East, but it's DC's government writing. It's not API doc.
Oh, okay.
Right? So it's different. And the only topic in seven camps so far, five on the West and two in the East, the only topic that has crossed both sides is UI UX.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that makes
sense. That's the only one. So we've got a professor from the iSchool, University of Maryland, who is coming to do a workshop at Camp on the East. If you were at the closing keynote at Summit, she was on the panel. We've got a we got a professor from GMU who is in the TechCom department certificate program, and she is creating a UI/UX course. So she's going to be one of the keynote speakers, and we've got somebody coming from South Carolina. I think that's just one of the Carolinas. He's the current chair of the chapter down there. He's a professor at a local university. He's going to come and do a keynote on content strategy because that's the number two topic in the East, not in the West.
Right. Oh, really? I would have thought that the content strategy was big everywhere at this
point. Right? So, like, for me, it's fascinating because I can see there's differences in regions, right? And I like to see that kind of stuff. I don't know what Keith and Rob are going to do. They're probably going to tack camp onto the end of a regular conference up in Toronto, a couple-day conference.
Okay.
Right? Because up there, things are different. It's a different audience, different writers, different goals, different kinds of companies. We'll see what happens. I don't know. They're still deciding. So,
okay. Well, it's cool that UX UI is consistent. I mean, I've seen recently a new title that, to me at least anyway, called UX Writer. So I don't know if that's it seems like it's kind of what we do, but as technical communicators, but with a new twist. So I'm wondering, is that the way this is going? Because I think it's time for TechCom maybe to reinvent itself and maybe not call it TechCom anymore. But I'm wondering if UX Writer is the new tech writer.
I think that's the appropriate title for technical writers who want to rebrand themselves into UI UX. Out here, I've talked to multiple hiring managers who are, they're all software companies. And they've had writers come in and say, hi, I do UI UX. And they look at them and like, no, you don't. UI UX is a discipline if computer science. It has been around for 30 some years, right? So to walk in and say, hey, I do UI UX and I don't know any of this computer science stuff, you're immediately disqualified from jobs. So that was part of what we're trying to do with Camp in the East this year, is at least bring people who have been, and all of the keynote people have worked as UI UX people as in software as well as in TechCom, right? So they're going to come and say, hey, these are the vocabulary things you need to know. This is how you have to, how you react and interact with software people who are trained in UI UX as a discipline. We're looking at this as a huge way to help the entire community grow their professionalism. Because, I hate to see people shot down when they try to do something because they didn't quite know what they were walking into.
Yeah, that's a tough one. So, where are we going from here?
I know. I can keep going because, I work from home most of the time and I'll just keep talking.
let's go. All right, so you were talking about conferences. You say you volunteer. You've got TC Camp West. You got TC Camp East. How many conferences are you at a year? And do you do that as part of, as part of the promotion for your business? Or you do it because you enjoy it, or a little bit of both, or just because you're a little crazy?
Some of both. It is primarily a business marketing opportunity, right?
Okay.
That's what it is. We usually have a booth, right? The whole thing and tchotchkes and stuff like that. You saw me at Summit. I don't always do all the conferences. I don't always do the same ones year after year. It changes. I've gotten more interested. It shifts for me, right? I used to did a North America every year, and then there was a period where they didn't want me there. And then there was a period where I did a lot of LavaCon and I didn't do a lot of the STC stuff. Now I'm doing a lot more of the more regional things. I love Summit and Spectrum, especially in Interchange. I'll go to different chapters. I flew to the Vegas chapter one year in the same night. I got to the airport, I flew to Vegas, took a taxi to the venue, gave my presentation, and took a plane home. It took just as long to do as if I went to the East Bay's Christmas party from traffic perspective. So,
Oh my goodness.
It's the community service side is huge for me. It's just part of who we are and just what we do. We dedicate time to public projects all the time. We ran the Arbortext user group for a long time. So this year was just local conferences. I'll probably be at Interchange in October. I don't usually do any conferences out of the U.S. because we are not allowed to sell Arbortext outside of the U.S. We have partners who do that.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. So how many people do you have on your team? I know you have a business, but how many people work for you, if you don't mind me asking?
I want to say right now we're 5 or 6 people come and go. I have a librarian, actually a reference librarian, who works with me on occasion, or a couple of them who come in and go. Because, you know, if you're doing metadata, if you're doing any kind of taxonomy, you need a librarian there to work with you. What they do. They put books on shelves, and they make sure people can find those things on the shelf. Right? Mm. That's what they do.
Yeah. Right.
I've got a graphic artist. She does all of that for me. The TC Dojo and all that stuff is her work. She's amazing, actually. She's a classically trained painter. I've got somebody who specializes in windchill. I've got a great partner who, she did HR, she did sales, she did recruiting. So she's much better at picking up and putting down the phone. I'm a computer scientist. I'm the SE, you know, that's what I like to do.
Nice. So let's talk about, you have a really good social media strategy, I think. I know you've got your personal account, you've got your single sourcing account. I think you've got a third account. And it seems like you've got, like, I was very impressed by Summit. You had timing down. I think you had maybe scheduled your tweets to go out at the right time. I was like, holy crap, this is awesome. Do you do that all yourself? Or are you doing, I mean, how you, what's your strategy, I guess, or how are you managing all
of that? So I've been doing that all day today, actually.
I'm glad I asked.
So right now I'm the publicity chair for the San Francisco Bay ACM also. We do some of the stuff for camp and the stuff for here. Right now I'm working out. It's just, you got to work through it. You got to churn through it. There's no way to go. Like, what are you trying to target? Where do those people come onto your scene? Where do purchases happen? What's the timing of the day and the week? And, so I was working out today, like, here's the 6 products we do, and here are the 5 focused topics that we work on. You know, what day is the best day for each one of those to happen? Is it morning or afternoon? And for some of it, it's clear, right? For mil-spec or government people, you never do that stuff on a weekend. Those people just do not care about that stuff. They're off for the day. They're done, right? Search for stuff, not Monday, because that's their day back to work. That may look Tuesday. You know, I'm probably trying to figure something out by Thursday. And then you've got, you know, how many ways can I write this? And you get tired. It's a very creative endeavor, right? Cause you can't just put something out once, right? It's got to come 3 or 4 or 5 times before it really penetrates someone's consciousness. Oh my God, this was the topic of, the conclave this week. Cause everybody, we've got a bunch of independents who are growing their own consultancies. And we were talking about, you know, how do you spin the text? How many times do you have to publish, and where do you publish, and how do you, it's all stuff we know as tech comm people, right? What's the audience? Where are they? Who are they? What do they look for? Right. You can't just be, hey, I do everything, because nobody looks for everything. Right. You look for whatever thing you're trying to fix.
Right. Yeah. Good point.
So, so I've spent all day laying out the pages, the topics I want to cover, the subjects I want to cover, the products I need to cover, what day of the week or month or in time of day things happen. And now I'm starting to write out the messages and how often do I want them to repeat or when do I want to schedule them. You know, and it takes a lot of prep to get all that stuff in, because so that you can just move it around and schedule it. But yeah, I'd be dead without scheduling.
Yeah, that sounds exhausting. Now I know. I know when we were started talking at Summit that you had this thing you gave me a link to, you could schedule your time with Liz Fraley. I was like, this is so freaking cool. And I guess that's what keeps you on task.
Well, that's my new experiment, actually. You know, many experiments. That's my new one. I actually, because people do come to me for like, they need 15 minutes or they need half an hour. Right. And then really, that's all that they need. They don't need a fancy $200,000 retainer to get me to solve their problems. They want to solve them themselves. Mm. They want to know how to fix it so that when it comes around again in 6 months, as we all know it will, they can fix the problem. They'll remember, oh, yeah, it's something like this, and they can get started at least. Right. We're unusual for consultants that way. We want you to do it yourself. We want you to be as competent as the rest of us are. It's more work for all of us. Right. That's so what I sent to you was the new scheduling thing that we have. You got, I'm not sure which, I've got a couple of variants of the landing page, and one for people who are brand new and just need advice from, like, they got a brand new military project and they don't know what they need and they don't know how to start and they don't know how to install it, but the government is waiting for their documents. Right. They can call me up and book 15 minutes. They can pay for it. And we hit the 15 minutes and we're done. Right. Oh. Yeah. It's a great way to keep your budget under control and know that you have control over that.
Nice. Well, that sounds really cool. I have to ask you, I mean, you've got your volunteering, you've got the dojo, the conclave, you've got conferences, you've got your own business. That's exhausting. Yeah. What do you talk about, and what do you do when you don't talk about technical writing? Or is there any time left
over? There's always time left over. I garden, not so much this year, because it's just, I haven't got it all figured out. I've got volunteer tomato plants instead. I read. I read more than anyone should ever want to read. I went through almost 240 books last year. I'm closing in on 170 already this year. It's just part of who I am. I don't necessarily know all the answers, but I sure as hell know where to find them. And I can direct people, like, you know what, you need to go look at this, or you need to go research this, or here's the keywords you need to go look at. Cause you know, that's just part of the researcher personality that I have. So I read a ton.
Nice. Well, good for you. What are you? Well, what's the top three or four books that you're reading right now?
I'm waiting on a mystery writer out of Philadelphia. She's got a book coming out in a week. Lisa Scottoline. It's a lawyer crime novel. So I'm waiting on that. That's a she's really good. And I read a lot of that stuff. I try to keep one nonfiction book around. And the one I'm reading is, I think it's called Morality Politics by George Lakoff. That's the one that's, I pick it up and read a little bit and then I put it down and I read some trash, and I pick it up and read a little bit more and I put it down and read some trash. Cause you can't, I need time to noodle on stuff. Let's see, what's the third one? I don't know. I just finished a series, a mystery series by a writer of it's set in Wales. And that was kind of fun. So I think maybe I'll have a look and see what that is, because I've never been there.
That'd be nice to go. A little chilly though, I think. I don't know, it might be cold there.
Definitely don't go in winter.
Yeah. Well, that's for sure. I don't think you go anywhere in Europe during winter, really. So are you a physical book reader or are you a Kindle
reader? I'm a Kindle reader.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, me too. I was able to get up physical books pretty easily, so people still look at me weird, but I think I get much more done on a Kindle or on a Kindle app.
Yeah. It's so light. You don't have to hold it. Your hand doesn't get, it's just so easy. Right. Honestly. I mean, I can have 3,000 books in my command, which I do.
Right.
I'll tell you, I use, I'm a Mac person and I have an iPhone, but my Kindle is actually an Android tablet. Yeah, oh, wow. And I use one of the on ebook readers on there. I don't even use the Kindle app mostly. because it has, and it sounds really weird, it has a screen reader, which is really decent.
Oh, okay.
So you get that computer voice, right? But you actually get pretty used to it if you hear it enough. But I can read and then switch to voice and go wander around the house or wander around the office or whatever I'm doing. And it'll keep playing the story and I can do dishes or whatever. And that, I don't like the Audible books as much because I really don't need somebody acting up the story. I'd rather create that in my own head.
Oh, see, I love Audible. I, you know, between podcast and Audible, that's my commute on the train most of the time. And I love it. Honestly, I like having the Audible. I don't get to listen to it as much as I'd like. But I really like having that audio and having it acted out to me, I guess is what I like.
Yeah, most people do. I've been using this screen reader for like a year and a half now. I can actually, you get used to it and I can picture it and put whatever spin I want on it.
It's in my own head. Nice. Yeah. Cool. All right, Liz. Well, thank you for everything. And that was a hell of a lot geekier conversation than I thought we were going to have, but it was pretty awesome.
All right. Well, edit me away.
Can you let our... You know, no, God, no. I, you know, other than the flubs that I make, usually there's very minimal editing in my podcast. So, we've got Liz full geek and in the flesh. So, nice. Do you want to share with us where people can find you online?
Sure. You'd go to social.single-sourcing.com, and that's a page that's got everything on there. It's got all of our public service projects and everything that we do, and there's two dozen of them, maybe. I don't know, a lot of them. Thanks.
That's a very cool idea. To aggregate your social stuff, I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, I've got links to all my social stuff on my site, but to have it in one place that why didn't I think of that? See, you've got this content strategy thing down pat. That's pretty
awesome. I like to play with stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Thanks for having me. So glad to be here.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, you know, you still owe me a little time on the XSL.
Absolutely.
But I think I've narrowed down so much more than when we talked initially that I can kind of focus in on that. So you and I will geek out a little bit further soon. But until then, everyone else, you can find me on Twitter at Ed Marsh and, of course, at edmarsh.com. You can subscribe to the Content Podcast on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, and the Google Play Music Podcast Store. We would love it if you write us a review and let us know how we're doing and let everyone else know how we're doing. For links on how to subscribe, you can go to edmarsh.com/podcast and subscribe using your favorite podcast client. I use Beyond Pod on Android. They don't pay me to say that, but I've been using it for years and years now. So I like to get the word out there. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Why don't you go out there and create some good content?